Dr. Harrison, where were you born?
I was born in Charlotte on September 13, 1936.
And which area of Charlotte is that?
In Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how long did you live there?
Well, I lived in Brooklyn all my life, really. I was, like I said, I was born and raised there. I attended elementary school, middle school, high school there. So I was there until I left for college, right, in 1958. So from 36 to 58, that was the...
Okay.
Right.
And as you were saying before, you attended Winston-Salem State.
Winston-Salem State University, okay. Yes. It's a teacher's college at the time, but now it's diversified, grown a bit, and I think become really more utilitarian institution. At the time I was there, it was only a teacher's college. That is, I should correct that. When I went there, it was only a teacher's college, but they added a nursing program. So it was teachers and nurses. So, right.
And you graduated from there, and you went on to get a master's degree at, you said, Indiana University?
I went to Indiana University, yes. There's sort of an interesting, for me, it was an interesting thing. I had been in African-American settings all my life. And I decided against going to A&T, where many of the people were going for masters at the time. And I decided not because of A&T per se. What I wanted to do was test my academic abilities. I wanted to see how I could fare, how I could compete with other students from other nationalities and races. So I decided to go to Indiana. Indiana because it would have provided a heck of a lot more diversity, and it was reasonable in terms of cost.
And from there you went on and got your PhD?
After a while, not immediately.
No, I
worked a while. In fact, I didn't entertain the idea of getting the PhD until I actually moved away from Charlotte. And my work environment provided opportunities for me to do a PhD, so I decided to take advantage of it. Yeah.
So after you graduated from Indiana University, what did you do? What was your work?
When I went to Indiana University, I was an elementary teacher here at Charlotte. And upon graduating from there, with some emphasis on administration, I decided to submit my name for possibility or consideration of principalship here in Charlotte. So I was successful in getting a principalship. So after Indiana and after the master's degree, I became a principal here in Charlotte.
You said you were an elementary school teacher,
mm-hmm.
and you became a principal later on. Where were you an elementary school teacher?
At Meyer Street in Brooklyn.
Meyer Street.
Yes, I became a teacher at the school in which I had attended. Yeah. So it was very special going back to work with the people who had tutored and taught me, mentored me. It was very special. I was still the kid, the young kid on the block, and I revered those teachers and learned a lot from them in the profession, just as I've done as a student.
And as a principal?
As a principal, I had the privilege of working at Biddleville's elementary school, which no longer exists. Biddleville existed down Batesford Road. And it was torn down because it was in the path of a highway.
And that highway is?
Is that the number 49 or highway number 49 or whatever it is? That was a part of the highway and also part of the extension of, I think, the railroad, something down there, I don't know, some overpass. But anyway, it was in the path of, we were told, the highway, and they had to tear it down. So I closed Middleville Elementary School and then opened Bruns Avenue, which still does exist, but not as a K through six. I think it's a specialty school. And I say that because I've lost contact with the schools. I left here, I was gone 30 years and came back and haven't become reoriented to what's happening with many of the schools here.
Okay. So you were gone 30 years. What happened in those 30 years?
Well, I had an opportunity. Well, when I left here, I left to go to work for the Regional Education Laboratories of the Carolinas in Virginia. That was located in Durham. I worked there for 1 year and then went to Princeton, New Jersey to work with Educational Testing Service in a variety of capacities, including director of the SAT, director of the National Teacher Examinations. I worked as an executive associate with one of the vice presidents there, and also served as director of the Northeast office, Northeast Field Service Office, which had its office partly in Princeton and partly in Boston, Massachusetts.
So you were instrumental in putting together and implementing the SATs, the ATs, and some of the other standardized tests?
Well, as program director, you have overall responsibility for ensuring that those tests are put together and are printed and administered and scored and all of that. I was not one who wrote the items, so that was not a part of my responsibility. My responsibility was administrative and supervisory for each of those examinations.
And when was this? When did you?
Let's see. I worked as a teacher and principal for a combination of 12 years, and then went to Princeton, I guess, in around 70, 71. And between the Educational Testing Service and the College Board, from which I retired as the executive director for the Middle States Regional Office, I spent 19 and a half years of educational testing and 12 years with the College Board. So I was gone a pretty long time. So getting back to your question about what took me away from here, it was to work first in Durham and then in Princeton, and my the office from which I retired was in Philadelphia.
So when did you come back to Charlotte?
2.5 years ago.
2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically you say that you were born in Brooklyn, grew up in Brooklyn,
right.
You attended the high school, and which high school?
Second Ward.
Second Ward.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What's your earliest memory of Brooklyn?
Oh.
Or the one that sticks out?
Well, I think my earliest memory of Brooklyn would be it was the neighbors, the neighborhood, which served as sort of an extension of your family. Brooklyn was, you had your nuclear family, of course, but really everybody in that neighborhood was a part of your family. And the adults were surrogate parent. There was absolutely no doubt about the fact that they had every right to discipline you if they felt the need, every right to care for you if they felt that there was a need. And when I say care for you, if they, in case of hunger, in case of need for clothing, there would be no doubt that people would take up their responsibility to ensure that these needs are met. So those are, I remember that very vividly, as do I remember the churches and the importance that the churches, the roles that those churches played in the lives of kids. Going to Bible school, I was a member of the Brooklyn Presbyterian Church, but I remember going to the convocations for the House of Prayer every year, and I remember the parades that they had. And I also remember something that many people might not have given thought to. I remember the students who, the kids who were members of the House of Prayer being so devoted to their church that nothing came between their attendance at their services and their convocations. I mean, absolutely nothing. Whether it was attending schools, attending games, or whatever, if there was a church, if they had a convocation activity or something related to church, they were going to be there. And I thought that that was the kind of devotion that I didn't see in many of the churches. Except in my later life, I saw the same kind of devotion in Catholic churches. You know? So those are some of the recollections that I have. And of course, the Lincoln Theater and the Savoy, and I remember Second Street and First Street being very lively places on the weekends. When I say that, that doesn't mean that I was out gallivanting or just having a great time. I would walk through there with adults, from time to time, and I would see that they were just wonderful, wonderful settings. I also recall the library in Brooklyn, and there was something about that library that you don't find today. You walk into that library, and it was as quiet as we used to say, as a funeral parlor, because it was just not the kind of place where a lot of conversation was carried on. You went in there to read, to think, to cogitate, but you did not go in there to carry on lots of conversations. The memories that I have of Brooklyn are very, very positive and very special. And I've often thought that it's so tragic that that community had to be destroyed in the name of, and I say this very sarcastically, progress. I don't buy the progress argument. I just don't buy that argument one bit. Sure, there were things that needed to be done, improvements that needed to be made, but the entire community did not have to be razed or destroyed in order for those things to happen. I think if you look in other communities where they pride, where they placed a premium on protecting certain types of property, those properties have been maintained. But that wasn't thinking in Charlotte at the time. The so-called, and I don't know why they would be called so-called, city fathers. Fathers, I don't think I would use that term for so-called fathers. Had other, ulterior motives in mind. So it happened. You look at a person like myself, and I was telling a group not long ago, they were saying, okay, now all of us are going to sort of give a biographical sketch, talk about, who we are, what we are, and how we came to be. And I said, I sort of feel like the kid that never was, because when I look to my, the house in which I was born, it's no longer there. When I look at the house in which I was raised, it's no longer there. My church is no longer there. My elementary school is no longer there. My high school is no longer there. My community is no longer there. So, it's like all of these physical things have been just eradicated or wiped off, just demolished. But those memories are there, and that's why I value this place, this house, because it helps helps me re-engage with the past. Like I said, Brooklyn's very special.
Speaking of, go ahead.
No.
Speaking of this house, we're in the Second Ward Alumni House.
Yes.
How do you interact with the Alumni House, the Alumni Association? Tell us about that.
Upon returning to Charlotte, there were a few things that I really wanted to reconnect with. And one of the things was the Alumni Association. And at the last meeting of the Alumni Association, which is last Labor Day weekend, I was privileged enough to be elected to the foundation board. And at the foundation organizational meeting, I was asked to serve as second vice president for foundation, Alumni Foundation. So that has given me an opportunity to work with people who are much more familiar with the foundation and the alumni initiatives than I. And I want to learn from them and make whatever contribution I can to the perpetuation of the memories of Second Ward.
Second Ward is the high school that you went to.
Yes.
What are your memories of Second Ward?
Oh, my gosh. The Second Ward High School, there are just loads of memories. You can go date back to the, I can go back to the kinds of friendships that were established there, which are enduring. Many of the people who attended Second Ward along with me are just special people, special friends. One of the guys and I attended Winston together, and we taught school in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg together. We attended the same church. We were singing in the same church choir. We were singing in the same community chorale. We were on the planning committee for our 50th reunion. So that's just one example of the kind of enduring relationships that I'm talking about. But in addition to relationships, I think back on the teachers and the commitment that they made to the students, how they cared about students, not just as students, but about, they cared about us as though we were their own, as though we were their children. And they taught us, they were concerned about more than just the subject matter, because they knew that learning the subject matter, mastering the subject matter, was only it was an important part of our development, but it was only a small part of our development. We had to learn other coping strategies. We had to learn how to deal in a society that was ever changing. One that they were not, we were going to have to deal with the kinds of things that they did not deal with. And they tried to help us understand that you've got to look ahead, you've got to think ahead, you've got to be able to deal with that person who is now the mayor, the city director, the school board chair. You may be sitting in those seats in the future, so you've got to prepare yourself in order to be able to take advantage of whatever opportunities that present yourself. And going back to the word opportunity, they helped us understand that opportunities don't knock time and time again. They knock, once or twice, and you got to be ready when the opportunity knocks to take advantage of those. Those were some very special lessons for me. There was something else that happened. I was a member of a band when I was in high school, and our band director took over a band that had maybe 15, 20 people in it. And within a year and a half to two, he had better than 100 people. And he didn't play a lot of this, contemporary stuff, whatever it's called. He introduced us to the classics. He helped us learn the value of classical music. He had us playing classical music within a year and a half. I remember him having us march in the Christmas, Christmas carousel, the Christmas parade. He had us dressed in Santa Claus uniforms. That year, we won, I think, second place as the band, for our performance. And I recall some white kids along the parade route calling such things as, "Mama, Mama, I didn't know there were black Santa Clauses." that was a fond recollection. But another thing about our band teacher that I felt was very important, a lesson that sticks with me today. He told us that time is a very important commodity. He would start a concert at 7:59 and a half. In other words, when his clock said 7:59 and 30 seconds, he was raising the time. And when he raised the baton, the doors closed, and people didn't come in until we had gone through our first set. To this day, I am obsessed with being on time. I just cannot stand being late for meetings or for anything. And I learned that lesson from my band teacher in high school. I learned other things, the importance of working with your hands as well as your mind. I took auto mechanics, and I tried, now I'll try fiddling with a car. Of course, you can't do too much with these modern cars, but some of the older models where you can change spark plugs and change oil and, do certain things. I learned some of those basics in high school. In high school, we also had to take home ec. So we learned how to iron your clothes, how to do some basic cooking. When my wife and I get into a tiff, I say, I can cook for myself. I can wash for myself, although I don't fool with the washing machine. I'll just hand wash things. I can iron. But these things help you become self-sufficient. And I can't thank Second Ward enough for that. So those are some of the recollections that I have. The friendships, the committed teachers, I like this word utilitarian, subjects that I took. I learned the importance of time, and I love to appreciate music because of my band teacher. And by the way, I was not a part of it, but they had a dynamite choir, and they did some beautiful, beautiful music. Even now, when I get in my car, I turn the radio, it's preset to a couple of stations. One is 89.9, which is a classical music station. And one is 88.9, which is a jazz station. Now, the jazz, because as a part of my involvement with the band, I played in our little jazz band. And I developed a love for jazz because of that, or through that. So many, many things that stick with me that came from, that emanated with, or originated with something.
Who were these teachers? Your band teacher, your auto mechanics teacher, your home economics teacher, and some others, who were?
L. Augustus Page was the band teacher. Mr. Page is since passed, and his flag was home ec. I can't remember, sadly, the auto mechanics teacher. But I think back, Mr. Diamond, French teacher. And by the way, he's had quite an influence on just this place, because his daughter is sort of the caretaker. He was our French teacher. There's another teacher that I should mention, because that teacher did have quite an influence on my life, and that was Mr. Jones, Cedric Jones. He was a journalism teacher. The little writing that I learned how to do while I was in high school, I learned through my journalism class. So I do respect him for what he did, and really thank him for helping me learn how to begin putting sentences together and deal with some of the mechanics of English. That was sort of honed when I went to Winston-Salem, but it began back at Second Ward.
Seems that you've learned a great many lessons in your Brooklyn upbringing and from Second Ward High School.
Oh, absolutely.
How have you passed those lessons on in your career?
Well, it was not difficult to do. I mentioned that I was privileged enough to go back to work at Meyer Street, having worked there. I remembered some of the things that, many, many things that were taught to me, and some of those important lessons, and those are the kinds of things that I try to impart to my students. But not just to the students, but to the parents as well, because many of the parents were young. And I think I was able to relate to them, because I was a fairly young teacher myself. And when I became principal, I was a fairly young. In fact, I became a principal at age 26. So I could relate to many of the teachers, many of the parents, as not just principal to parent, a professional to parent, but person to person. And that's the way I like to relate. I don't like to use titles and credentials as, I just don't walk around with my credentials on my shoulder. PhD is fine, but that's that was just a hurdle that you had to overcome. I don't walk around saying to people that I'm Dr. This or Dr. That or I've been this or I've been that. It's just not that important. What's important is whether how you relate to people and how people relate to you. The fact is, many times people who are much younger can teach you an awful lot. And very often people who have far less education can also teach you an awful lot. So you got to be open-minded and very receptive. I think if you're open-minded and receptive and responsive, make that out.
You talked about the relationships that you formed at Second Ward and throughout your time in mm-hmm. Brooklyn and beyond. Who were your friends? Were they all people from the Brooklyn community? Were they just Brooklyn people?
Well, those friends were at the outset, of course, people that I went to school with, I went to church with, and they were people who were within that fairly close community. But that changed, you know, as I became older and a little more advanced at Second Ward, because the guys would begin to date the girls at West Charlotte. And the girls, and you know, vice versa. So you got to know people on the west side of town as well. So those friendships and those relationships expanded, you know, over time. So I have friends who went to West Charlotte as well. Probably more who went to Second Ward. And of course, that circle of friendships developed even further once you went to college. There's a different kind of relationship that you develop there because you live with people. You don't live with people, you know, you went to high school with. You would see them on, you know, a daily basis. But you'd see the people in college not only on a daily basis. They're there when you wake up and go to sleep, and you know. So it's a different kind of relationship. But I got off track there. Fact is, my circle of friends did expand in the Charlotte community because you know, dating and also because of bands. Our band used to sort of get together and just sort of, you know, we would have, I forgot what they called it, but it was sort of like high school bands performing together. So you got to know people that way. There were other instances where, well, this was not with the black school, but it was with the one of the white schools put Christ Back into Christmas, where you would meet with you know, students from other schools and get to know them that well. We just I can't say that we developed any friends through that, but some acquaintances.
Talk about you being a member of Brooklyn Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the activities you took part in at Brooklyn Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm. Yes. At Brooklyn Presbyterian Church, I became, I was on the choir there, and I became an elder. In our church, and again at a fairly young age, right after I became principal. I don't know that I would recommend that to, but yeah, I became an elder in the church, and again sang on the choir. But again, the very hurtful thing was our church, which had been built by many of the, when I say built, I mean people laid bricks you know, actually built that sanctuary. It was in the path of urban renewal, so it had to be destroyed. So our church merged with with 7th Street Presbyterian Church. And shortly after that merger, I guess I was leaving Charlotte for the Northeast, so I didn't get that involved with that merged congregation before leaving, but I did reunite with them when I came back. So I am back there as a member of what is now First United Presbyterian Church.
Now we get to urban renewal.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of urban renewal, what do you think about? What does that phrase mean to you?
I think of it as, let me be as kind as I can. I think of it as an excuse for dismantling African-American communities, or an excuse for dismantling communities of disenfranchised individuals. Excuse me. So I don't think very kindly about urban renewal. I don't know that it was. I think philosophically, it probably, excuse me, has its merits. But in reality, I don't think that it has lived up to its billing. I don't see a heck of a lot that was renewed. I see a heck of a lot that was dismantled. And I think that but for the resilience of the people who are removed from those areas, things could be, the communities could be, and people could be in shambles. But I think the people were very, very resilient. And they have gone about, making a life for themselves without forgetting Brooklyn. In fact, it's so amazing to me when we lose somebody to death, how people just, it's sort of like a rallying cry. And I saw that happen 2 or 3 months ago. A young lady passed rather suddenly. Excuse me. She was not one of the persons who was, the politically astute person. She was not into every organization that you can find. She was not one who had degrees hanging, around her neck and all of that. But she was a loving person, and she was a loved person. And the people who turned out to pay their respects for her, to her and her family, just unbelievable. The church is standing room only. But that gets back to the urban renewal thing. I really don't have a lot of love for nor respect for the so-called city fathers. And by the way, I would not. I think it was spelled fathers with very small letters. I just don't have a lot of respect for the people who were making political decisions at the time. I think the intent was not to renew or reinvigorate community. It was to one of those, let's separate. And as we separate, we can just sort of further disenfranchise people. So that's for what it's worth.
You talk about the disenfranchisement of
mm-hmm.
Brooklyn. In what ways was Brooklyn disenfranchised by urban renewal?
Just torn apart. I mean, If we wanted to renew the area, we would have said, okay, here, 14, 15 churches here that made a very important, they've been very important to the growth and development of our community. So rather than, just tear these places down and say, well, you can rebuild elsewhere if you want, we'll help you. We'll do whatever we can to sort of help you regain a footing and redevelop. Same thing with the schools. Sacramento High School was the first black, my street, first elementary. So do we want to preserve these schools? Do we want to preserve the legacy of these schools? Do we want to preserve that which these schools have contributed to the community? If so, we can do that through urban renewal, if in fact that's our goal. That wasn't a goal. The goal was to destroy and, get rid of those schools, promise them that we are rebuilt, and those promises will be enough to sustain people. But people won't, become hostile and all of that. It's just make promises. That's why I don't have much respect for those who were making those political decisions at the time. We were uprooted, we were removed. I can go down Independence Boulevard now and I can see the steps. The steps remain to my home, my house. But that's about it. I try to be positive and see some positiveness in these. I don't see all that.
How did you learn about the decision? About the urban renewal.
I guess first through my church, because I was not politically involved at the time. I was pretty young, so I learned through my church, and we went through a lot of agony about what are we going to do? Are we going to rebuild? Are we going to dissolve? Are we going to merge? Are we going to just buy a church that's already built? The reality of it all was, and I was not too young to realize this, the reality was that we did not have the kind of economic base to buy a church, to build a church. I was surely hoping that we would not dissolve. I knew that the only option that we had was merger, but that was not an option that many of the people wanted to accept. But I think it was a presbytery that said, you're not in financial position to do anything but merge. I don't know what you call it. It was an economic. I had studied the resources of our church. I mean, I'd look at the number of people who were there, and I'd look at the not just the numbers, but the actual members. I looked at where they were working, got some sense of the kind of money that they were making, got a feel for what they were contributing. And then sort of made a projection. What the income that we are now, the money that we are now taking in the revenues, what kind of church can we buy? What kind of can we do? And the fact is, we couldn't buy a lot, not to mention a church. Because many of the contributing members there at the time were people who worked in what we call service. They were domestics. They had, like my father was a janitor. And he's not going to be able to contribute a lot of money to church. My mother was domestic. She couldn't enter the home. So, the realities just sort of forced us into the merger, which was very good, and it worked out well. But the fact is, it moved us away from Brooklyn to downtown. And now, when you look at Brooklyn, let's see, the only church that I think remained, the only historical black church in